Welcome to Return of the Veda with George Quandt, a unique 12-part weekly series that will, through insight, science, and the evolution of consciousness, trace the footprints of contemporary meditation and modern wisdom to its ancient roots. Each week, your host, George Quandt, will select a guest from a panel of experts on meditation and its broader context of Vedic science and quantum physics.
Welcome to the show. I'm George Quandt, your host, with guest co-host, Dr. Devashish Banerjee, who is most qualified to lead this in-depth interview with our distinguished guest, Ulrich Morhoff. On today's show, we're going to share the insights and wisdom of these extraordinary individuals and how they eloquently incorporate the teachings of Sri Aurobindo into their life's work. And I must say firsthand, they also enrich the lives of so many through their interpretations and their insights into the parallel universe and its relationship with the world of subatomic particles and matter, from Vedanta to the quantum. No stranger to this show, Dr. Banerjee completed his undergraduate studies in English literature from the University of Bombay and has a PhD in Indian art history from UCLA. He is an authority on Indian contemporary art and philosophy, which includes the writings of Sri Aurobindo and the Vedas. His book, based on his dissertation, The Alternate Nation of Tagore, is presently in press. He teaches courses at the University of Philosophical Research, Pasadena City College, UCLA, and UC Irvine. Ulrich Morhoff studied physics at the University of Göttingen, Germany, and at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, India. While attending the Sri Aurobindo International Center of Education in Pondicherry, India, he studied Indian philosophy, and particularly the works of Sri Aurobindo. As an independent researcher and faculty member of the Sri Aurobindo International Center of Education, he currently teaches a philosophical-oriented course of contemporary physics. A book on the subject is currently in the works. His primary areas of research include the foundations of contemporary physics, its ontological implications, the mystery of consciousness, and the place of physics in the context of a larger reality and the nature of this larger reality. He's the managing editor of Antimatter, an online journal which addresses issues in science and the humanities from non-materialistic perspectives. He has published numerous papers in academic journals of physics, philosophy of science, and consciousness studies, and has given numerous lectures at conferences on quantum physics and on Indian psychology. So, speaking to us from Pondicherry, India, welcome to the show, Ulrich.
Well, hello, George. Nice to be on the show.
And speaking to us from Los Angeles, California, is Devashish. Thank you both for joining our listeners and agreeing to talk about this fascinating subject. I wanted to take the time to introduce you both properly. So I'm going to turn it over to you now, Devashish, and I'll chime in as needed.
Thank you, George. Ulrich, before go to the ontological implications of quantum physics, which is really what you've most eloquently expressed in many of your papers, let's get to some background. Why did it become necessary to even invent quantum physics? What was inadequate in what is now called classical physics that necessitated this? Could you give us a brief selective history for this, Ulrich?
Yeah, sure. We have to look at the situation in physics at the beginning of the 20th century. there were a lot of data that had been collected by careful observation, which had no explanation whatsoever in the context of classical physics. Hundreds of thousands of spectral lines had been cataloged. You know, when you heat an atom, it emits a characteristic line spectrum, and there was no explanation for it. Then, if you heat what is called a black body, it's basically a dark body that doesn't reflect but only emits radiation because it is heated, it will again emit a particular spectrum, and no explanation for that particular spectrum was at hand. In fact, if you apply classical physics to that problem, it says that you ought to get blinded by ultraviolet radiation if you look at the burner of your stove. So luckily, classical physics was wrong and this on this and many other counts. It could not explain why atoms are stable. It had no theoretical basis for chemistry's periodic table of the elements. So basically, in the microscopic domain, classical physics had nothing to say.
Right.
The beginning of quantum theory then was in 1900, Planck's explanation, first calculation and then explanation of the black body spectrum. That is to say, the spectrum emitted by a glowing hot object. Then there was an important experiment made by Geiger and Marsden. They were shooting alpha particles at a gold foil, and they expected, you know, to go these heavy particles to just pass through almost undeflected. But what happened that once in a while, an alpha particle just ricocheted back, and Rutherford said this was as incredible as firing a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper, and it came back and hit you.
Wow.
So that the lesson was that all the mass of the atom must be concentrated in an extremely tiny volume, so that it was the atom was essentially empty space, but there was a very, very dense, massive nucleus. That immediately led to the idea that the atom was like a miniature solar system, you know, with the sun at the center and planets, electrons in this case, orbiting around it. But it took a few minutes for people to realize that such an atom could never be stable. So it then was Bohr in 1913 who postulated that a specific quantity of the atom called angular momentum is quantized. This means it can only take on specific values, not a continuous continuum of arbitrary values. And it took, it's very interesting because this simple postulate out of the blue made it possible to predict exactly the spectral line of the hydrogen atom. I mean, that was a tremendous success. But then it took 10 years before somebody came up an explanation of why angular momentum is quantized. And that was de Broglie in 1923. And he was thinking of the electron as if it were a standing wave on a circle. And if you try to fit a wave, okay, standing just means that the nodes don't move. If you try to fit a wave on a circle, then of course you will realize that the wavelength must, or rather the circumference must be an integral multiple of the wavelength, otherwise it will not fit. And this this condition leads immediately to the quantization of angular momentum that was postulated by Bohr.
I see.
So there was something extremely right about thinking of electrons as waves, mm-hmm. but it was not right to think of them as waves on a circle, because the circle was still a relic of the way of thinking of electrons as little things that orbit.
Right.
So Schrödinger corrected that and said, no, let's think about the electrons as waves in three dimensions, in full three-dimensional space. Mm-hmm. Well, and that was it. That was the Schrödinger equation, which is at the heart of quantum mechanics. That was 1926.
Right.
Now, two more important steps I want to mention in the development of quantum theory,
yeah.
that is both dating to 1927.
Mm.
This is Born's, Max Born's interpretation of the Schrödinger equation as an algorithm that allows us to calculate the probabilities of the possible outcomes of possible measurements. It's just that. It's just a probability calculus.
Hmm.
Then, to answer the question, you know, why the heck does our fundamental theoretical framework give us just a probability calculus and nothing more directly relevant ontologically?
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the same year, Heisenberg formulated his so-called uncertainty relation, which say, for example, that such conjugate quantities as the position and the momentum of a particle cannot simultaneously have precise values. And the sharper the value of one, the fuzzier the value of the other. You know, uncertainty is actually a poor translation from the German word used by Heisenberg, which is literally translated as fuzziness. And that's precisely it. There is an objective fuzziness at
right.
the micro level. It is, I mean, it is everywhere, but it's very easily discernible at the micro level. And this is essential for the stability of matter. So, you know, you can say the fact that matter doesn't collapse the moment it is created, a material object, or explode, is due to the fact that it is made of atoms which are stable, and atoms are stable because the relative properties, that is to say, the relative positions of its parts, the relative momenta of its parts, are fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this is an absolute objective property because it accounts for an absolutely objective fact, which is to say that matter as we know it exists. You know, material
right.
objects don't collapse or explode the moment they are formed.
Right.
So it's an objective fuzziness. It's not just, you know, it's not our subjective uncertainty
right.
about the positions of particles in an atom that makes atoms
right.
stable. That would be silly to say such a thing.
Yeah, many people make that mistake, but I see what you mean, that it is really an objective property. So, yeah, so yes, that was a nice brief history, Ulrich. Now, the whole formalism that developed as a result, quantum physics, also, you know, gave rise to certain what are known as weird phenomena. Now, can you say a little bit about these weird phenomena, which,
yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of why they are weird is only, I guess, to do with trying to develop some sort of meaningful interpretation of them. So, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, certainly. I would qualify a little bit what you just said, because weirdness is something that we must expect. It's
yes.
nothing specific to the quantum theory. Weirdness has to be expected from any fundamental theory for a very simple reason that was first made very clear by Werner Heisenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And you can formulate it like this. If you want to explain the features of the familiar macro world
Right.
In terms of some underlying structure, then this underlying structure cannot itself possess those features. You know,
right.
Because
right.
if it would itself possess those features, you wouldn't have explained anything.
Yes.
You want to explain how the macro world has these features without already in your underlying structure postulating those features. So which
yes.
means that your underlying structure will lack those familiar features, and therefore it will automatically be weird. You can't help it.
Yes. So there's almost like an intrinsic weirdness that we have to, admit to the very very act of explanation of this kind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're going only round in circles.
Correct. Correct.
That's like when you hop through a dictionary from one definition to another.
Quite. I wanted to come to your real major contribution, which is your.
Ashish, do you give me a minute for?
Sure. You want to say a few little more? Okay.
Say a little more on the weird phenomena.
Sure, please.
First of all, the main weirdness arises from a fundamental difference between classical physics and quantum physics.
Yes.
You know, both theories are about correlations.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, on the surface, you know, in classical physics, you can interpret these correlations causally, in causal terms,
mm-hmm.
and then therefore in mechanistic terms.
Mm-hmm.
Then correlations between causes and effects. If this happens, then that happens.
Correct.
Now, in quantum physics, we have probabilistic correlations.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, we have a number of no-go theorems.
Uh-huh. Yeah?
So for instance, Bell's famous theorem is one example.
Uh-huh.
And these no-go theorems, you know, they're basically negative results. They
uh-huh.
simply show that the mechanistic explanations will not work. And
right.
explanations involving causality will not work. And explanations
yes.
invoking an underlying structure or state of affairs will not work.
Quite.
You know, that is another aspect of the quantum weirdness, that everything we thought we are familiar with as working in classical physics doesn't work anymore. And then there are some features. Okay, I will just mention two more. There is a weirdness with respect to space, and there is a weirdness with respect to substance. And weirdness, again, simply because it's unexpected. It does not quite chime in with how we normally think about the world. So, with respect to space, the implications, of course, we are coming to more of the ontological implications of quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But here the implication is that the spatial differentiation of the world does not go all the way down.
Quite.
So if you take the world and you want to divide it into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller regions,
mm-hmm.
there comes a point when that partition, you know, that distinction between smaller and smaller regions exists only in your mind. It has no
Why?
Counterpart in the actual world. It has no objective reality.
Why?
And similarly, with respect to substance, you know, if you keep on dividing material objects, they cease to be, I'm coming to this actually a little later in more detail, they cease to
sure.
be distinct.
Sure.
They yeah. lose their distinguishability, and you can't even then speak of the ultimate constituents of matter in the plural. You know, because
yes.
they lose their distinguishability if you dig down deep enough.
Yes, Ulrich. In fact, this is a good segue, because this is exactly, I mean, it leads into your contribution regarding the ontological implications of quantum physics. So you've already touched on some of the, you know, aspects of that in terms of, you know, space and substantiality. Now, you have also related these ontological implications to the Vedic tradition and to the teaching of Sri Aurobindo by calling it the physics of Satchidananda. Can you elaborate a little bit on this? What is Satchidananda and how it maps to the quantum formalism?
I'll get back to Satchidananda. And if I remember rightly, it's also a term that you have already explained on previous shows with George Quant.
Yes, so we have dealt with it a little bit. I was hoping you'd be able to relate it in the special way in which you explained Satchidananda. Okay.
Yeah. But let me here again a preface, because we should keep in mind that we cannot do science without a metaphysical framework already in place. The role of this framework is to supply questions and to interpret answers, you know? So when we do science, we have already a metaphysical framework in place. I repeat that because I think it's very important to emphasize this is what supplies the questions we ask and this is what interprets the answers we get.
Right.
Now, and so if we take a materialistic framework, then we ask questions like the following, you know, what are the ultimate constituents? How are they put together? How do they interact with each other? And so on.
Yes.
Now, if we take a spiritual framework like the Vedanta, we would start with questions like the following. How does Brahman manifest itself? Now, I suppose you've been talking in previous shows quite a bit about Brahman, so let's take that for granted, yeah?
Yes.
Another question in this framework would be, how does Brahman enter into relations with itself? Another question one would ask in this framework is, how does Brahman present itself to itself under a myriad of aspects? Because, after all, that's what the world, the manifestation is in this particular framework.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So these would be the relevant questions.
Right.
Now, a metaphysical framework, like the two I mentioned, is not itself testable or falsifiable the way a scientific theory is testable or falsifiable. So when we speak of the ontological implications of quantum mechanics, we should be a little bit clear about this, you know, that this is not a straightforward direct implication, because the implication depends on the metaphysical framework that you apply to science, you know, which is not something that science itself provides.
So
what I'm prepared to say is that quantum physics makes a lot more sense when questioned Vedantically than when questioned materialistically.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, yes. I would definitely say quantum mechanics favors a spiritual worldview.
What?
But and here I come to also to the reason why so many famous physicists are saying things like nobody understands quantum mechanics. That's what Richard Feynman said, and Roger Penrose saying that quantum mechanics makes absolutely no sense. And Michio Kaku saying that of all the theories proposed in the 20th century, quantum mechanics is the silliest. You know, the reason for this is, obviously, for this assessment of quantum mechanics is obviously that they are trying to interpret it in a materialistic framework where it doesn't make much sense.
Absolutely.
So So I already mentioned some ontological implications that the world is not differentiated all the way down, you know, neither with respect to space nor with respect to substance.
Yes.
And this implication makes it impossible to model reality from the bottom up.
Right.
You know, whether it be by aggregation of material parts or by the association of physical properties with the parts of space or space-time. You know, in physics, relativistic physics, there are two common approaches. That's one is the particle approach and one is the field theory approach. So in the particle approach, one would talk about, you know, particles as fundamental entities, and in the field theoretic approach, one would talk about space-time as being somehow the fundamental entity and physical properties being associated with the points of space-time. So, neither approach will work if the world isn't differentiated all the way down, because then you cannot start from this bottom up, because this bottom does not exist.
Quite.
Now, reality is structured from the top down, and we could express this by saying that by entering into spatial relations with itself,
mm-hmm.
Brahman manifests both matter and space.
Ah.
Now, that can be made a little bit more clearer if I say what exactly I mean by matter and what exactly I mean by space, because space is simply that set of spatial relations mm-hmm. into which Brahman has entered with itself,
mm-hmm.
and matter is simply the multitude, the corresponding multitude of relata. You know, it mm-hmm. is one Brahman, but if it enters into relations with itself, then of course it also appears to be many relata, many Brahmans. So it's both one and many.
Absolutely.
So it's a movement
from the one to the many.
Yeah. And the one does not abrogate the many. They exist happily side by
Absolutely.
Side, caring
Absolutely.
Very little for our mental logic.
Yes.
but you see, none of these implications I just mentioned can be seen by anyone who is committed to a materialistic framework.
Mm-hmm.
Because a materialistic framework postulates a space-time that is intrinsically and completely differentiated. So, of course, you cannot see that this may not be wrong, because they assume this to be correct from the beginning.
Right.
And so that's just, I already mentioned, the silliness and absurdity demonstrated against by Penrose and Kaku. Kind of a direct consequence of the attempt to straitjacket quantum mechanics into a materialistic framework.
Right.
But then again, if I say it this way, it's like I'm saying it my way, because the inconsistency of the materialistic framework with those ontological implications isn't visible within either framework. You know, so it's really an inconsistency between metaphysical frameworks.
Yes.
And so we have to acknowledge that this is not something that can be scientifically resolved.
Absolutely.
So this is what I'm saying kind of in relation to claims which are popular with the New Age audience that quantum mechanics has kind of scientifically validated spiritual worldview.
Yes.
That is not the case.
No. But if one assumes the transcendental metaphysics, the metaphysics of Brahman, then
yes.
The world starts, the quantum world starts making sense, as it were.
Yeah, a lot of sense. Whereas otherwise, if you listen to Kaku and Penrose, they'll tell you how little sense it makes.
Yeah.
You mentioned also the physics of Satchitananda, which was actually the title I have given to one of my papers, which was an interpretation of physics in, I mean, what I mean by this title is an interpretation of physics in a Vedantic metaphysical framework, so
right.
which is what I have just outlined.
Mm-hmm. And but yet in it, Ulrich, you have something to say also about how Sat, Chit and Ananda are involved in staging the evolution of consciousness from a kind of sort of exclusive concentration of Brahman on itself to its relata. So would you, you know, elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. There are two things I already said. The first was that by entering into spatial relations with itself, yes. Brahman manifests both matter and space.
Right.
If matter and space are properly understood.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have also mentioned the question, how does Brahman enter into relations with itself? And so that's actually what you're asking about, I guess.
Yes.
And the answer is that this is a psychological process.
Right.
It's not a process of materialistic psychology, obviously. No? So the consciousness in question here is an infinite consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And its powers are infinite.
Yes.
And we are dealing with a self, not a, with a consciousness that has a very peculiar quality and is very importantly different with, from our mental consciousness with which we are familiar. In that the self of this consciousness, you can say the point of prospection, you know, the, from where this consciousness looks at its content, is coextensive with the content.
Right.
So it's a knowledge so much by identity that the self is always right where its objects are, wherever they are. It's coextensive with the content of its own consciousness. But then, that is, this is obviously what I have learned from Sri Aurobindo, it goes without saying. So, the same consciousness can then also, and does localize itself manifoldly within its own content, and so as to view and act upon it from a multitude of locations.
Right.
So, the consciousness localizing itself within its own content manifoldly, so there are many centers, you might say, from which now the self, the one self, acts into the content of its consciousness and views the content
yes.
of its consciousness.
Right.
Now, this consciousness can also and does make this multiple concentration of consciousness. You know, that's what Sri Aurobindo called, one can obviously call a multiple concentration of consciousness. No?
Yes.
This can be made exclusive, which
yes.
simply means that the individual consciousness or the individual self is no longer aware of its identity with all the other selves.
Quite, quite.
And this is basically what the Indian terminology calls avidya, the ignorance, no?
Yes.
Where you are just
yes.
not aware anymore of being one with Brahman
yes.
and with all the other selves. And
yes.
there are a number of qualifications in the way the world looks to you and the way you look at yourself that are automatic consequences of this transition. From, we can say, a supramental consciousness, which is always aware of the oneness of all self, to the mental consciousness, which is typically not aware of that oneness.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we can go further, there are, in this exclusiveness of the concentration
uh-huh.
of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
there are several possible degrees, with their corresponding results. And I would like to outline these different degrees of exclusiveness, and it will be very helpful for this to think of the creative process as a development that starts with infinite quality. You know, that is the Ananda in Satchit Ananda. That is Brahma characterized. Okay, let me, because you asked about Satchit Ananda, you asked me to say a bit more about my interpretation of the term Satchit Ananda. It is made up of Satchit and Ananda.
Mm-hmm.
And I would interpret this as three relations that exist. It is not, you see, it is not a characterization of Brahman itself, because that simply cannot be characterized. It is transcategorial, or as they used to say, ineffable. But we can speak of its relations to the world. And so, as such, it is the substance that constitutes the world, you know, such being a substance. It is chit, the consciousness that contains the world. Often chit and tapa.
You need to raise your voice a little bit.
Okay. Sat Chit Ananda. The second part is chit.
Yeah.
Which is usually mentioned in conjunction with tapas as chit tapas. So we can say tapas would then be that aspect of Brahman by which Brahman shapes itself, gives form to the world. And Ananda finally is an infinite quality or delight. You know, I use both terms because at the original level there does not exist as yet any duality or differentiation into subject and object. So therefore, you know, if we say bliss, that's right, but it is a kind of objective bliss. And then the way to characterize such a thing would be to call it, you know, like infinite quality, something like that.
Right.
So, and the process of creation would then simply be the development of this infinite quality into revealing forms.
Quite.
And there are two intermediate stages in this process. It proceeds via the formation of expressive ideas and the action of an executive force. So let me say this again. Infinite quality manifests itself via the formation of expressive ideas and the action of an executive force, which creates the revealing forms. And these four, there are four key terms here. These four terms that I have mentioned, that quality, idea, force, and form, they play such an important part in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, and he calls them, of course, Satchitananda, and then the idea that is the playground of mind, and then the executive force, that is the essence of life, and then the revealing form, that is the essence of matter. Now, if you increase the exclusiveness from the first involution of supermind into the individual mind, then you go further, you obtain the involution of mind in life, and if you carry this exclusiveness of the concentration, multiple concentration of consciousness to its extreme, then you arrive at the involution of life in matter. And now here the important point to be made is, what is life actually in this Vedantic or Aurobindonian framework? Life is what is responsible for the creation of Brahman's individual form.
Right.
Now if this involved in matter, the result is obviously a multitude of formless individuals. And that is, you know, the end of the psychological process by which the stage for the drama of evolution has been set. You know?
Yes, wonderful.
That is to say, one can now ask also the following questions. What laws are needed to regulate the commerce between this multitude of formless individuals, which are also known as fundamental particles or ultimate constituents of matter, And how, what laws are needed to regulate this commerce in such a way that Brahman's adventure of evolution can succeed, you know, that all its powers, faculties can gradually in reverse order establish themselves, manifest themselves, reveal themselves.
Yeah.
And the answer to the question, what is the fundamental regularity or the kind of lawfulness initially needed to set this stage for the adventure of evolution, the answer to that is simply the laws of physics exactly as we know them empirically. So this is the center point of my forthcoming book, that I'm showing that the laws of physics, you know, are precisely what we need so that this Brahman's adventure of evolution is possible.
Beautiful. That's beautiful, Ulrich, and I think that's a beautiful way to round up our discussion and, you know, bring our listeners into the whole arena of the evolution of consciousness and the quantum formalism as a description for the last sort of phase of this, the material phase of this. I think I will hand the mic over to George, and he will wrap up this show. Here you go, George.
All right, are you still there?
Yes, of course, George.
Thank you so much.
You hear me?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for a wonderful show. I'm actually wrapping up now, and I want to you know, give a special thanks for it to you and to Devashish Ulrich, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed the show. I know that they enjoyed it immensely, as have I. And I want to thank my producer, Gary Haskins, and I want to thank Karen Lyle and Rebecca and Raghu Banerjee for his keeping us on track and their professional input. And to the listeners, if you need to reach me, you can reach me at georgequant.com. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to Return of the Veda with George Quant. Tune in next week for more insight into the wisdom of the Vedic seers. Hear the revelations of the pioneers of quantum physics and discover the Da Vinci Code of meditation research in the Chronicles of Meditation segments. For more information on George Quant's IQ meditation course, go to georgequant.com.